we continue.
Can I bring your hand up, please?
Yeah, in the pink pants.
I have three questions, actually.
Take some water.
The first is, you said that you believe we should have an aggressive timetable to withdraw militarily from Iraq.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you feel the same about our corporate occupation of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is, if we didn't withdraw, you said that you thought the violence would continue to get worse, likely, and I'm wondering how likely you think it would be that a nuclear bomb would make it in that region, its way there. And the third one is, I'm incredibly grateful for your work in the world. I'm so glad that you could share it with us. And
it's not about me, it's about a very tolerant wife.
I'm wondering, you see kind of the worst that humanity is capable of, and maybe possibly therefore the best, and you also see the terrible kickbacks and connections and reprisals that maybe might come to you in your career, and I guess I'm just wondering how you keep going.
Let me answer the second question first. You know, I don't know about a nuclear weapon. I just don't know. And it only takes a few people and circumstances. How would I know? In terms of the last question, there's sort of an implication in there that there's something noble about this occupation as compared to pumping gas or something else. I went to St. Lawrence University as an undergrad. I was 17. I was a awkward nerd like most male 17-year-olds are. And I had taken AP Calculus in high school. And so I thought that meant I'd get to skip the first year when I went to college. So I did, and I went right into second year calculus. And I did really badly. I got a 1.5 first semester. I dropped out second semester. And in that calculus class, there was this young woman. And she was just kind of quiet and a little bit plain, but really lovely eyes and a really gentle manner. And we had meals a lot together. And she kept on offering to help me. You know, I was just like so embarrassed that I'm failing calculus. And she's so cool. She was a little bit overweight, but you know, in a quiet, gentle way. She was much cooler than I was. And she probably asked me 20 times over the course of the year. And I just was so embarrassed that I didn't ever really accept. And at the end of the school year, she went home to her house in Rochester and blew her brains out in a swimming pool. And she wasn't wanting to help me. She was wanting me to help her. I think all of us are cowards. I think all of us have moments when there's something we have an inner capacity to do but don't have enough self-confidence in us to do. And I am much more worried about having another moment like that than I am about dying. There's a lot of things worse than dying in my mind. And I've had unbelievable luck. I don't think of what I do as service at all. I get to be a mechanism of compassion in that conveyance system of humanitarian aid from the world's wealthiest to the world's least lucky. What a cool thing. 9 out of 10 kids in high schools, if they knew you could do that for a living, would think, oh, that's great, and would gladly do that.
You mentioned at the beginning that we needed, you know, to sort of leave and say, I'm sorry, Iraq.
No, those are two separate things.
Okay.
I think at this moment in history, it's incredibly important we express contrition when we've clearly made a mistake. Separate from that, even if you're going to send more troops, expressing contrition is really important. And separate from that, I think we need to get out.
All right. I wanted to focus on the contrition.
All right.
And a lot of us here were really very supportive of your primary run and, you know, felt that it moved in that direction. And I think a lot of us would like to understand a little bit about what happened in terms of the primary and why it was that you didn't have a shot at it.
So there's a lot of answers to that. and I'd like to sort of answer them, and I think what is the order of importance. The biggest thing was, politics is a dirty, complicated game, and I wasn't good enough at playing it. Early on, I made some big mistakes. I hired 4 people in an office and was spending money on the assumption that I was going to get some more in and could make it all the way to September. That was my mistake. So I never thought about running for office until Hurricane Katrina struck, and I was so pissed at Sherwood Bowler, chairman of the science committee, who had castrated all the most functional parts of our public health service by putting it into Homeland Security, that I decided to go after him. And once I decided that, the guy that started out helping me out did some research and convinced me quickly that he actually wasn't going to run again. He was going to retire. His spending was way down. Or pardon me, his money raising was way down. His spending was way up. So I went down to the DCCC right after the election. No, in early November 2005. And I walked in and I said, I think my Congressman Sherwood Bullard's going to retire. I think I could raise the couple $100,000 it would take to mount a serious campaign. And I want to know, would you be willing to support me? And they said, this is great. This, you know, we didn't even have this one on our radar screen. We never thought we could take this even. If this one's in play, we are all for it. And, you know, if you really think you can raise that kind of money, great. And I walked out the door, and I'm pretty sure at that moment they picked up the phone and they recruited someone to run in this district. And Michael Arthur Curie was the third person they approached. And I didn't understand. And now several Congress people have told me this. Never believe the Democratic Party, the DCCC. Assume, this guy Hoag, who was just elected newly in New Hampshire, said to me, assume everything they tell you is a lie. Assume they are stabbing you in the back and doing the worst thing they could possibly do to you, and you will never be disappointed. And several other people said it in slightly different ways. And so, I thought that I was setting up to try to get myself well known to win in a primary election. And that was just my ignorance. I didn't understand that when the machinery really wants to stop a primary, there's a lot of mechanisms they have in order to do that. I twice went up to Geneva to meet with the Ontario County chairperson, and both times he didn't show up for the meetings. And he endorsed Michael R. Curie before allowing me to ever meet his committee, for example. That was probably the most egregious example, but there were a couple other counties where things like that happen. When the party really wants to avoid a primary and focus on a person, they have tools like that they can employ. A good friend of mine's husband was ambassador to China in the Carter administration. And she lives in Washington, big-time Democratic insider, has a lot of sway in the House. She's sort of been a lobbyist, is I guess the right word, for an aid agency for 30 years. And she had a fundraiser and invited maybe 70 of her closest friends. I think 2 of them came because they had called up the DCCC and said, no, this isn't our guy. It's someone else in this race. And when Sherwood Bullard announced he was retiring, which must have been like February, beginning of March, the first words out of Rahm Emanuel's mouth that day were, Michael R. Curie is one of my top recruits. And the DCCC put his bio on their website, and they wouldn't put mine up. And then they stopped returning our calls. And it's just things snowballed. And there came a terrible moment in May when I couldn't say to my friends and family members, give me money because I have a good chance of winning. And B, when I thought staying in the race would diminish the chances of a Democrat winning. I pulled out of the race. According to the Cook Report, Michael R. Curie, or this district, went from the 20-something most likely gain for the Democrats to the 11th. It happened within 2 days of my dropping out of the race. So clearly the pundits thought avoiding a primary was a good thing. The flow of money to R. Curie from parties that didn't want to interfere before our primary happened started in a big way 3 months before it would have otherwise. I don't know whether my dropping out made a difference in whether Michael Arcuri won or not, but it certainly could have only helped him. And given that 13 months ago, I stood in a district where for 48 years we'd had a Republican representative, and I lived in fear that my idiot president would drop a bomb on Iran. Given where I was 13 months ago and where we are today, I almost couldn't be happier within the spectrum of what's possible. And it was really painful to voluntarily, of your own volition, drop out when you've raised $150,000 from your friends and family and whatnot, and gone into debt and done something for 6 months. It was excruciating, but given where I was at that moment, given all the mistakes I had made and inability to read the DCCC, that probably was the right thing to have done in May. Is that an okay answer?
So what do you think of Arcuri?
That he votes for a leadership in a way that my favorite congressman, Maurice Hinchey, has 10 times more power than he did a month ago. And we got a Democrat in this seat, and I'm ecstatic about that. I think Michael Arcuri is quite a nice guy. And there have been a couple of things he has backed, in particular the Military Commissions Act, that are just appalling to me. I've been taken prisoner in Bosnia. I was held as a hostage in Congo. And it's just unacceptable in any way that I could live in a country that condoned waterboarding or whatever it is you might want to call that I call torture. So, but I think he's a nice guy with an open mind, and I'm really optimistic that we can communicate with him and have some influence on him, even if you don't like something he said up till now. I mean, this is early on. He's a formative guy, and especially if 40 of you wrote a letter saying, you know, I really don't want you to vote this way on this bill, I would think, as a freshman who's insecure in a district that leans Republican, you could have more influence on his evolution than with virtually any other person in Congress. Yeah, please.
Let's see. First, I can't say enough. Thanks for coming. This is great. One is, were the people of Baghdad surprised at your study results?
No.
You know, do they understand the magnitude of the violent oppression that, you know, involved in the U.S. government? Mm-hmm. And then the other one is, I mean, I'm not naive, but can you give me just a little glimpse of what violent deaths are in Iraq? Because most of what we hear about are the IEDs that are blowing up Humvees that aren't armored.
Sure.
And we know a little bit about house raids, but, you know.
In answer to your first question, every reporter that's called me in the last 2 or 3 weeks, I've said that I'm really puzzled, because this is the easiest study, scientific study, labeled as controversial to verify that there's probably ever been. Whether Dolly the sheep was cloned or whether the University of Utah did cold fusion, it's not like some reporter for AP could just call up a couple people and figure that out. There are natural deaths from people growing old, from birth defects, and if Iraq is one of the healthiest countries in the world, there have to still be about 150,000, 140,000, maybe 130,000 deaths a year. There have to be. It's just from natural causes. 25 million people. That means since the invasion, there must have been about 500,000 deaths from natural causes. And so what I've been saying is, if what we're saying is true, there have been even more violent deaths. So if you go to a morgue or you go to a graveyard, 5, 6, out of 10 deaths in the last 3 years should have been from violence, if we're right. Most of them should have been from violence. If George Bush and Iraqi body count are right, 50,000 deaths, it should be 1 in 10 has been from violence. Every Iraqi knows that the morgues are full of mostly violent deaths. Every Iraqi knows a family member who's died. And so to say 1 in 40's died, several people, many people said to my friend Riyadh, no, it must be much more than that. It's more than 1 in 40 of my friends. So it was accepted just carte blanche. The vast majority of deaths over the last 3 years, and even more so in the last year, are Iraqis shooting Iraqis. That's 58% of the violent deaths. And gun deaths are 58%. And the bulk of them, we believe, are Iraqis killing Iraqis. There's a big portion in there, almost a third. We actually don't know who did the killing. But we think most of them probably also were Iraqis killing Iraqis because the coalition clashes are a little more transparent and a little more publicly known than the single killing events that happen at night. And someone's told in the morning, your husband's body is 2 blocks over. So, gunshots, Iraqis killing Iraqis. We cannot distinguish between criminal deaths and sectarian violence and political assassinations. And our interviewers, once we asked how did they die, can you describe the circumstances, we didn't want our interviewers to probe because then people might get suspicious, people might get angry. It might have ended up our interviewers getting killed. Hi.
Everybody talks about physically getting out of Iraq, but I wonder if you could help us understand how. John Murtha always says, we're just going to get out. But it's such a difficult country and where it is, and I don't know how you get out of here.
It's not my place to make that call. I would want to put it on the Iraqi parliament and the Iraqi president to make that call. But it is abundantly clear, and this is already happening, this is already part of their plan to try to get certain provinces completely under control of Iraqi security forces and to sort of limit the places that our troops go to. Unfortunately, there's all this talk about need to control Baghdad, and Baghdad's probably the most impossible to control by military means and the most necessary to control by political alignment and agreement. So I think we're doing that backwards. But my answer is, on a brutally aggressive timetable, tell the Iraqi security forces, you need to take this province by the end of January. You need to take these 4 provinces by the end of February. You need to take these, and we're going to be moving back, and we're going to stay in the Kurdish territories last before we pull out. Leaving from the Kurdish territories or the extreme south, Muthanna, which is relatively nonviolent, would lead to the least of people shooting at our tails as we're going away with all our trucks and helicopters. So it is a, I would think it needs to be a geographically phased process. And if we're going to be out in 6 months, it's got to start next month. I mean, it needs to happen in a really systematic, agreed-upon way with the government. Yeah, please.
I have 2 related questions that don't sound that related, but I think they're very related. The first question is that the people that I talked to about your first study who found it credible were without fail the people who heard about it on This American Life.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, did you approach them? Did they approach you? Are there ways to use that kind of, to do something viral so that better information permeates the American conscience in a more reliable way? Mm-hmm. My second question that I think is somewhat related is, I'm happy that you have some faith in the Democratic Party, partly because I was devastated by what happened to you without knowing the details from anyone firsthand. It was very clear what happened to you, and it really shook my faith. It was like the last nail in the coffin. And I'm wondering if you see a way to make any of these spineless jerks do the right thing. And writing a few letters, maybe that's all we can do, but I'm wondering if there's anything else you think that we can do.
No, you can do a lot more. A few letters is one thing. The Democratic Committee of Tompkins County saying to Mike Lockyer, if you vote this way on this Military Commissions Act, we will do everything we can to replace it. That would put fear way down deep into his heart. I mean, I think there are things above the letter level that you could do if there was something that bothered you about your political figures. in terms of that first comment.
Which I think are related, because I think that when information actually permeates the American public, it kind of limits the ability of the Democratic Party to go off on its own.
Yeah, I think that we need Bernie Sanders-like third-party candidates. Not everywhere. They don't need to control a third of Congress, but if there were enough players out there to make the game more honest, I think it would put pressure on the Rahm Emanuels of the world to play fair. I don't think this is the district to try that game, because thank God we got a Democrat and it leads Republican in a huge way. I think the 25th district, Syracuse, is a district where a third-party candidate would be risking little and could gain a lot. So those are two thoughts.
Is that Walsh's district?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's just a despicable guy. So if there's anyone who's worthy of going after, he's the one. In answer to your first point...
A little bit cool at the same time.
I don't know enough about him, but I'll take your word.
Despicable.
Well, cool's worse than Walsh.
That's hard to imagine, but okay.
He's not a Democrat. He's a Republican. Cool, so.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
I know.
That's right.
I'm struck that everyone knew the statistics about AIDS in Africa for a decade, and nobody cared. And then there was this little window of time, and it was in a summer, maybe about a decade ago, when the Boston Globe, the New York Times, the Washington Post got together with CNN and Time Magazine and a bunch of media outlets, and for about a two-week window, they bombarded Americans with stories about individuals in Africa with AIDS. They took all those statistics and they turned it into sort of an emotionally appealing story that people could understand. Millions of people dying isn't just the expense of a coffin, it's children who don't have parents. It's families who had to feed this person for 7 years as they withered away, and they weren't doing anything other than lying there, and the family couldn't earn enough money, and all the family got malnourished, and the two children died. They sort of got the contextual meaning. And the This American Life show turned our statistics into an appealing story. I think that is the way that all important social lessons have to come across. That we just see this again and again in terms of economic issues. I mean, no one cares about the facts. It's like the emotional connections that work within society. This American Life, let me back up. That first time, the highest profile interview I had was Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Mm-hmm. Our opponents were on CNN, all the really high profile thing, but that was my biggest sort of media encounter. But I did probably 100 interviews, and one of them was with Chicago Public Radio, a local news channel that interviewed me for an hour. The producer from This American Life heard it on the radio when he was driving his car, and he had in his mind dismissed the Lancet study as an October surprise weird thing, and when he heard that, he sort of was stunned and went back and he read the article, and then he called me up, and the process began. So no, I didn't approach them. They approached me. Yeah, please.
Back to the political landscape. Are you familiar with the Clean Money, Clean Elections campaign? Some of us are very involved with trying to get that to happen, and that's a way that we could get third-party candidates in.
Yeah. No comment other than yeah.
This is going back quite a way to an earlier comment that you'd made, and it's the only thing that surprised me. You put it in the context, if I heard it properly, that if we were to leave precipitously, one of the things that might happen would be Iran-Turkey conflict hostilities. And again, if that was accurate, that, again, is the only thing that surprises me. I hadn't thought about that at all. What do you see or know that might precipitate that?
I don't know anything. I have perceptions. My perceptions are based on as little as all those people advising President Bush. Clearly, Iran is working hard to become a greater force in their region. Clearly, Iran, in the way Muammar Gaddafi was trying to 15 years ago, has a political leadership that's gaining its credibility and regional power by standing up to us. So for us to essentially fail next door to them, and probably when they are supporting our failure behind the scenes, would strengthen them enormously in the way that Hamas was strengthened enormously, not for winning in Lebanon in this last little crisis, but for not losing. And I mean, this would be exponentially greater sort of political gain in power. And for a long time, the President Bush, you know, everyone says he didn't run, the first President Bush, the real President Bush, didn't run into Iraq because he didn't want to get caught down a quagmire. You know, separate from that was the factor that he liked having Iraq there to neutralize Iran so that there was no one force in that part of the world that could sort of hold sway and have a lot of influence. And if we left in a really precipitous, disastrous way, Iran's capital would skyrocket. That's just my basic take.
I'm with you on everything there. I just didn't no longer detect any friction with Turkey in particular.
I think the issue is there that Turkey had said if the Kurds declare an independent state, they will invade. They have openly stated that again and again. They've actually backed down from that in the last 12 months or so. Turkey is kept at bay by the Americans. And so if the country fell apart, I am sure the Kurds would declare independence. And if we weren't in a particularly strong position with regard to Turkey, we would not be in any position to keep them from invading. And the Kurds despise the Turkish government. If you remember in the first Gulf War, a bunch of Kurds ran up to the border and tried to run into Turkey, and Turkey wouldn't let them in. 60,000 died over just a three-week window when they weren't allowed into Turkey, stuck behind barbed wire on their border. There is enormous hostility between those two groups. And I just think Turkey's entry would just escalate our regional conflict almost certainly. Because they would be greeted with even less warmth than we are now. Please.
I teach college students, and I'm wondering if you could give me some ideas about how to talk about this in a not necessarily extensive way, but some sort of touch points to convince them to at least start thinking through some of these issues.
My first point is, we have had staggeringly bad information in Iraq. The weapons of mass destruction business in the beginning. I don't know if you remember, right before the 2004 election, our Pentagon spokesperson kept saying, it's okay, we're shelling Fallujah. The city's almost empty. We think it's down to 3,000 to 5,000 people, and that they're mostly foreign combatants. By saying that, both in Iraq and in America, it made it okay to just be shelling the heck out of folks and killing them if they're foreign combatants who have come in. So we surround the city for these months. We're shelling. We invade right after the election. We capture 1,600, kill an unknown number. Of 1,600, 30 were identified as foreign combatants. So most of 3,000 to 5,000, take a sample of who you capture, 30 of 1,600. So most 2%. That was the city that the U.S. military had had the most military activity in of anywhere in the world since the Vietnam War. And if our intelligence was that bad, or if our spokespeople lie that profoundly, we've got a problem of trust in what our government is telling us. The week after our study came out, the Minister of Health said, I don't think it's true, I think 150,000, when he'd been saying 40,000 to 50,000 just the week before. If he can triple his number, because we've said 600,000, it means they don't know. So I think the message would be, here is a scientific study. It's not perfect, but it's based on something on the ground. And everything else we're getting is filtered through propagandists. And as was said, peer review information should carry a little clout. That was a really long answer, and you were looking for sound bites, sorry.
No, I mean, that's what I was looking for, was just some way to start to get in. Because my goal in my classroom is not to make sure that they walk out thinking what I think. Right. In some ways, my goal is to ensure that they don't really ever know what I actually think. Mm-hmm. But the goal is more to get them to start thinking. Because, you know, I have this little magnet in my office that says, think, it's patriotic, you know, which could be right next to something that says, think, it's free. It certainly costs them a lot less to think than to go to Ithaca College. But yet they come to Ithaca College, they pay a lot, well, their parents pay a lot of money generally. And so they need to walk out with something. And if what they can walk out with is some media literacy or some critical thinking or, you know, so there's the place to start is to say, here's an idea. Here's this. This is a fact. Why is it a fact? Because of X, Y. Here's the other piece of this. This is what we were told. Now you start doing the math.
Right. There's a group at Ithaca College that if you don't know about them yet, you should get in touch with Sylvie Scheid and Bookshark.
Yeah.
And that's an awesome resource up there for doing exactly this, the media literacy bit of let's look at what we're being told and why we're being told that.
And another, a different angle is to say, well, what do we know? The lowest estimate I've seen is that we've fired 200 million rounds of ammunition in Iraq. 200 million rounds of ammunition. That's almost 1,000 rounds per resident. By the end of 2004, we had dropped over 50,000 bombs. Is that the story you're getting on NPR and the New York Times? I find that shakes some people when I say that way. Are you going to end it?
We're going to take the last. We're going to wrap it up soon. So a couple more questions. And
why don't we just say arbitrarily we'll take 3 more questions?
Okay. Just a side comment: if that's the amount of ammunition we're losing,
right,
and we only killed the number that they say, they have bad shots.
I think the level of violence that we use is pretty inconceivable. So when I was at St. Lawrence University, the public radio host was this gal named Martha Foley. And there was this one time when I was out with my boss, who was the librarian, and we were riding around on a Sunday, and she'd been invited to Martha Foley's house for dinner. And I said, well, you know, I'm not invited. I can't go. And she said, oh, don't worry about it. Don't worry. Just come. And, you know, still, I'm like a nervous, awkward, now 20-year-old. And so we're walking up to Martha Foley's house, the host of public radio. And as I'm walking up, I see her look out her window and see me. She doesn't know I'm coming. And as we get closer, I see her over at the sideboard taking a plate off of the sideboard and putting it on the table. And by the time I got into the kitchen door, there had been an extra place set. And it was never mentioned that I wasn't invited. So when my wife and I are chatting, we sometimes refer to Martha Foley moments as meaning invisible grace. So there I am. I'm in a hotel room in Baghdad. I'm looking out my window, and I'm listening on a satellite radio to National Public Radio. And it's a Sunday with Leanne Hansen, I think. And on comes Martha Foley giving this little essay. And she's talking, in September 2004, she's talking about picking blueberries in the North Country with her granddaughter. And I'm looking out the window, and there are these two helicopter gunships start circling around something. And she's talking about what a beautiful blue sky there was that day, and the leaves have changed, and it's just so magical. And they start firing down, and I don't know whether it was machine guns or cannon fire, but you know, the machine guns fire 1,000 rounds per minute. And they're circling and circling, and they circled for several minutes. And, you know, here I'm hearing Martha Foley talking about all the food she's going to make with her blueberries when she gets back home. And these guys, with the tax money I paid, are just raining misery down on someone. And pretty soon, there's a black plume coming up. You know, they had to have fired 20,000 rounds in the time I watched them. And so first of all, just what a surreal moment to like have the absolute most wonderful and the absolute most brutal aspects of American civilization, like coming in through different senses to your head. That was, just, I can't quite describe what it was. It was just surreal. And I think our mechanisms of engagement use incredible amounts of weaponry. And it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me. Well, we'll take this question, then we'll end.
What you were saying about Iran, is it totally unrealistic then to consider that Iran and Syria might be approached to help in some multinational?
No. I think Iran does not want anarchy next door. You know, there's all this talk about Shia and Sunni and whatnot. Iranians are Persian. Iraqis are Arabs. I think, in terms of basic emotions when you're walking on the street having a transaction, that's a bigger distinction than Shia and Sunni. And Iran does not want anarchy next door. I don't think the needs are as acute for Syria because it's fundamentally a more stable country. I mean, Iran is a country of leaders despised by their population. They don't want instability. They don't want us to look good. So if they can somehow arrange it so that they take part and keep things from blowing up and we get embarrassed, that would be their ideal outcome. And maybe we have to accept that. Did I answer your question? Did you have a response?
Yeah, I just wanted to re-raise one of my questions. Sorry. I'm sorry about that. You spoke about the having an aggressive timetable for military withdrawal from Iraq, and I'm wondering if you could speak to corporate withdrawal from Iraq.
Tomorrow. When I was running for Congress, and I came here the first time, I said that the perception we were there for oil is the fundamental reason we are despised. This imperialist stuff, I mean, that's like secondary language that comes after everyone's perception we were there for oil. Things have gone beyond that. There is sectarian violence that supersedes the perception we're getting robbed now. But, you know, I said at the time we should have publicly stated that all American oil, all American companies will leave Iraq and not do any profit, not make any profit or do any business with Iraqi resources for a 10-year period. Now, if Microsoft wants to go in and sell software, that's separate. But in terms of natural resources, we should have a 10-year prohibition on any Americans doing business just to project the image, hey, guys, we are not there to loot your oil. No, no, no. And I even think today that doing that would create us a tiny amount of political space within Iraq and would complement withdrawal.
Epidemiologist Les Roberts, author of two studies on Iraqi civilian deaths from violence since the U.S. invasion. He spoke on November 17th in Trumansburg, New York. Last week, in our ongoing reading of The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto, Gatto showed how the development of coal-fired machinery brought about a deliberate restructuring of society through its economic relationships, creating a new centralized economy with the power over the necessities of life concentrated in the hands of an oligarchy, and how the system of compulsory schooling was put in place to create people useful to this new system. We continue in Chapter 8, A Coal-Fired Dream World, as Gatto writes. The democracy which rises unprompted when people are on the same footing was finished with the coming of coal-fired steam locomotives. Before railroads, production was decentralized and dispersed among a myriad of local craftspeople. It was production on a small scale, mostly with local raw materials, by and for local people. Since horse-drawn vehicles couldn't reliably expect to make 30 miles a day, weather was always a vital reality in that kind of transport. Mud, snow, flooded creeks, dried up watercourses in summer, all were forces turning people inward, where they created lives of profound localness. On the seacoast, it was different. There, trading was international, and great trading families accumulated large stocks of capital, but still production wasn't centralized in factories. The pressure of idle capital, however, increasingly portended that something would come along to set this money in motion eventually. Meanwhile, it was a world in which everyone was a producer of some kind, or a trader, entertainer, schoolteacher, logger, fisherman, butcher, baker, blacksmith, minister. Little producers made the economic decisions and determined the pace of work. The ultimate customers were friends and neighbors. As mass production evolved, the job of production was broken into small parts. Instead of finishing things, a worker would do the same task over and over. Fragmenting work this way allowed it to be mechanized, which involved an astonishing and unfamiliar control of time. Human beings now worked at the machine's pace, not the reverse. And the machine's pace was regulated by a manager who no longer shared the physical task. Could learning in school be regulated the same way? The idea was too promising not to have its trial. Workers in mass production workspace are jammed closely together in a mockery of sociability, just as school kids were to be. Division of labor sharply reduced the meaning of work to employees. Only managers understood completely what was going on. Close supervision meant radical loss of freedom from what had been known before. Now, knowledge of how to do important work passed out of local possession into the hands of a few owners and managers. Cheap manufactured goods ruined artisans. And as if in answer to a capitalist's prayers, population exploded in the coal-producing countries, guaranteeing cheaper and cheaper labor as the coal age progressed. The population of Britain increased only 15% from 1651 to 1800, but it grew 13 times faster in the next coal century. The population of Germany rose 300%, and the United States 1700%. It was as if, having other forms of personal significance stripped from them, people turned to family building for solace, evidence they were really alive. By 1913, coal mining afforded employment to 1 in every 10 wage earners in the United States. Completion of the nation's railroad network allowed the rise of business and banking communities with ties to every whistle stop and area of opportunity, increasing concentration of capital into pools and trusts. "The whole country has become a close neighborhood," said one businessman in 1888. Invention and harnessing of steam power precipitated the greatest economic revolution of modern times. New forms of power required large-scale organization and a degree of social coordination and centralized planning undreamed of in the Western societies since the Egypt of Ramses. As the implications of coal penetrated the national imagination, it was seen more and more by employers that the English class system provided just the efficiency demanded by the logic of mechanization. Everyone to his or her place in the order. The madness of Jacksonian democracy, on the other hand, the irrationality of Southern sectionalism, the tradition of small entrepreneurialism, all these would have to be overcome. Realization of the end product of a managerial mass production economic system and an orderly social system seemed to justify any grief, any suffering. In the 1840s, British capitalists, pockets jingling with the royal profits of earlier industrial decades, and reacting against social unrest in Britain and on the continent, escalated their investments in the United States, bringing with their crowns, pounds, and shillings a political consciousness and social philosophy some Americans thought had been banished forever from these shores. These new colonizers carried a message that there had to be social solidarity among the upper classes for capital to work. Financial capital was the master machine that activated all other machinery. Capital had to be amassed in a few hands to be used well. and amassing capital wasn't possible unless a great degree of trust permeated the society of capitalists. That meant living together, sharing the same philosophical beliefs on big questions, marrying into each other's families, maintaining a distance from ordinary people who would certainly have to be ill-treated from time to time out of the exigencies of liberal economics. The greatest service that Edith Wharton and Henry James, William Dean Howells, and a few other writers did for history was to chronicle this withdrawal of capital into a private world as the linchpin of the new system. For the moment, however, it's only important to see how reciprocal the demands of industrialization and the demands of class snobbishness really are. It isn't so much that people gaining wealth began to disdain their ordinary neighbors, as it is that such disdain is an integral part of the wealth-building process. In-group disdain of others builds team spirit among various wealth seekers. Without such spirit, capital could hardly exist in a stable form, because great centralized businesses and bureaus couldn't survive without a mutual aid society of interlocking directorates which act effectively to restrain competition. Whether this process of separation and refinement of human raw material had any important influence on the shape and purpose of forced schooling, I leave to your own judgment. It's for you to decide if what Engels termed the contradiction between the social character of production and its control by a few individuals was magnified in the United States by the creation of a national managerial class. That happens in a very short span of time, in the last quarter of the 19th century. In 1700, it took 19 farmers to feed one non-farmer. A guarantee that people who minded other people's business would only be an accent note in general society. 100 years later, England had driven its yeoman farmers almost out of existence, converting a few into an agricultural proletariat to take advantage of machine-age farming practices only sensible in large holdings. By 1900, one farmer could feed 19, releasing 8 men and women for disposal otherwise. Schools during this period, however, remained trapped in the way things used to be, unable to deliver on their potent inherent potential as massifiers. Between 1830 and 1840, the decade in which the Boston School Committee came into existence, a fantastic transformation built out of steam and coal became visible. When the decade began, the surface aspect of the nation was consistent with the familiar life of colonial times, the same relationships, the same values. By its end, modern American history begins. Chicago, a frontier fort in 1832, was by 1838 a flourishing city with 8 daily steamboat connections to Buffalo, the Paris of Lake Erie. But something to rival steam-driven transport in importance appeared at almost the same time: cheap steel. The embryonic steel industry, which had come into existence in the 18th century, revolutionized itself in the 19th when the secret of producing steel cheaply was revealed. Formerly, steel had been bought dearly in small quantities by smelting iron ore with coke, converting the resulting iron pigs into wrought iron by puddling. This was followed by rolling and then by processing fine wrought iron through a further step called cementation. Steel made this way could only be used for high-grade articles like watch springs, knives, tools, and shoe buckles. The first part of the new steel revolution followed from the discovery of the Bessemer process in 1856. Now steel could be made directly from pig iron. In 1865, the Siemens-Martin open hearth technique gave a similar product of even more uniform quality than Bessemer steel. The next advance occurred in 1879 when Thomas and Gilchrist discovered how to use formerly unsuitable phosphoric iron ore, more common than non-phosphoric, in steelmaking, yielding as its byproduct valuable artificial fertilizer for agriculture. These two transformations made possible the substitution of steel for wrought iron and opened hundreds of new uses. Steel rails gave a huge push to railway construction, and structural steelwork marked a stupendous advance in engineering possibilities, allowing a radical reconception of human society. Capital began to build for itself truly global associations which made national sovereignty irrelevant for a small class of leaders as long as a century ago. And that fact alone had great relevance for the future of schooling. As steel articulated itself rationally, vertical integration became the order of the day. Iron and steel reached backward to control coal mines and coking plants, and forward to acquire rolling mills, plant mills, wire drawing facilities, galvanized iron and tin plate establishments, rod mills, etc. Small undertakings were sucked inexorably into large trusts. Every one of the most modern developments in technique and organization pioneered by steel was echoed in the new factory schools. Increase in the size of the plant, integration of formerly independent educational factors like family, church, library, and recreational facility into a coalition dominated by professional schooling, the specialization of all pedagogical labor, and the standardization of curriculum, testing, and acceptable educational behavior. What confused the issue for the participant population is that parents and students still believed that efficiency in the development of various literacies was the goal of the school exercise. Indeed, they still do. But that had ceased to be the purpose in big cities as early as 1905. Schooling was about efficiency. Social efficiency meant standardizing human units. Surprisingly enough to those who expect that institutional thinking will reflect their own thought only on a larger scale, what is an asset to a mass production economy is frequently a liability to an individual or a family. Creating value in children for a mass production workplace through schooling meant degrading their intellectual growth and discouraging any premature utility to the larger society. Elwood P. Cubberley inadvertently spilled the beans in his classic Public Education in the United States when he admitted compulsion schooling would not work as long as children were allowed to be useful to the real world. Ending that usefulness demanded legislation, inspectors, stiff penalties, and managed public opinion. New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Indiana, North Carolina, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Rhode Island led the charge to seal off the escape route of useful work for children, just as they once led the drive for compulsion schooling in the first place. The child labor rhetoric of the day was impressively passionate. Some of it genuinely felt and needed. But the cynical aspect can be detected in a loophole created for show business children, professional children, as they are called in the argot. Whether the work of a child actor is less degrading than any other kind of work is a question not difficult for most people to answer. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. One dramatic illustration of the positive philosophy in action is written in Coal Dust. As a heat source, coal seems a simple trade-off. We accept environmental degradation and the inevitable death and crippling of a number of coal miners, 350,000 accidental deaths since 1800, 750,000 cases of black lung disease, and an unknown number of permanent and temporary injuries, in exchange for warmth in cold weather and for other good things. But all sorts of unpredictable benefits flowed from the struggle to make the business of keeping warm efficient, and the world of forced schooling was dictated by coal. Consider the romantic gaslight era, which by 1870 as far away as Denver and San Francisco, graced the nights of American villages and cities with magical illumination made possible by coal gas produced when coal is purified into coke. In addition to allowing the steel industry to replace the iron industry, the major unforeseen benefit turned night into day as settlements blazed with light. And with illumination, coal had only begun to share its many secrets. It was also a storehouse of chemical wealth out of which the modern chemical industry was born. Coke ovens produced ammonia liquor as a byproduct from which agricultural fertilizer is easily prepared. It's also a basis for cheap, readily available, medium-yield explosives. Coal yields benzol and tars, from which our dyes and many modern medicines are made. It yields gas, which can be converted into electrical energy. It yields perfumes and dozens of other useful things. During the production of coal gas, sulfur, the source of sulfuric acid vital to many chemical processes, is collected. Coal tar can further be refined into kerosene. From 1850 to 1860, the German scientist August Wilhelm von Hofmann, working at the Royal College of Chemistry in England, made discoveries inspired by coal's extraordinary hidden potential, which elevated chemistry into a national priority in those countries which maintained extraterritorial ambitions like the United States. By 1896, heavier-than-air flight had been achieved, long before the Wright brothers, when a pilotless steam airplane with a 40-foot wingspan began making trips along the Potomac River near Washington in full view of many important spectators. As great as coal and steam engines were at stimulating social ferment, they met their master in oil and the internal combustion engine. Coal is twice as efficient an energy source as wood, oil twice as efficient as coal. Oil made its debut just as the Civil War began. As with coal, there had been ancient references to this form of liquid coal in Strabo, Dioscorides, and Pliny. Records exist of its use in China and Japan in the pre-Christian era. Marco Polo described the oil springs of Baku at the end of the 13th century. All that was needed was an engine adapted to its use. The first patent for the use of gasoline motive power was issued to England in 1794. By 1820, at Cambridge University, men knew how to use gas to move machinery. By 1860, gas engines were in limited use all over Europe, 400 in Paris alone. The first American exploitation of any importance occurred at Seneca Lake, right here, New York, in 1859, not a long ride from the ancestral home of the Rockefeller family in the town of Bainbridge. Following the lead of coal, oil was soon producing a fossil fuel transformation of American society, even though irregular supply kept oil from achieving its dominant place in the energy pantheon quickly. But by 1898, the supply problem was solved. 12 years later, oil replaced coal as the energy of choice, delivering advantages by weight, saving labor in transit, storage, and extraction, and just as with coal, undreamed-of bonus benefits were harvested from oil. In 1910, a windfall of 3 million horsepower hours was generated from waste gas alone, thrown off by oil used in blast furnace operation. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. To download his whole book, go to johntaylorgatto.com. And to download an MP3 or podcast of this and previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests, go to our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.